Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now, a visual novel about one of history's bravest conscientious objectors. In April of 1933, German Chancellor Adolf Hitler issued the Aryan Paragraph, language in a law that revealed his intent to deny German Jews of their rights. Most of Germany's clergy accepted it, but not Dietrich Bonhoeffer. The young theologian went on Berlin radio to denounce it and warn of Hitler's ambitions. You might be familiar with Bonhoeffer's life and death in the Nazi regime, but you've probably never seen the story of his courageous work and his time as a spy told the way writer and artist John Hendricks tells it in his new book. The book, aimed at middle grade readers, is titled The Faithful Spy, Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the Plot to Kill Hitler. And John Hendricks joins us this morning from St. Louis, Missouri. John, welcome. I've really been eager to talk to you. I'm glad you could do the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm interested in the visual representations and the color choices that you made for the pages. So we should explain that the book is a combination of text and illustration, but I think you've used a color palette that reflects some deliberate choices, and I'd like to hear about how you made those decisions on colors.
Oh, yeah, it's a great question. The color was obviously part of the storytelling here. So if you, if you haven't seen it, it's hard to maybe describe, but it's a two-color limited palette. So it's this teal color and red, and it creates, this sort of interesting effect where Dietrich's pages, his story is told in the teal color, and Hitler and the rise of the Third Reich in Germany is in the red. And then as their stories slowly intertwine, the colors overlap, creating this almost 3D sort of dislocated visual effect. So you start to feel the color making you unsettled as a reader and sort of painting that portrait with the story.
So here's something I noticed, and I think what you've just said verifies this, that there are times when Bonhoeffer is represented as the lonely voice of rationality. I know that he had supporters, but on these pages, he is seen as solitary, often kind of cool, cold, isolated, and you use the color palette really well to send us that that interpretation, that message.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting. Oftentimes we think of color in terms of hue, red, orange, blue, green.
Right.
But in this case, I'm using color as more of an emotional signal. So I think it's a way where you can tell part of the story without telegraphing it literally to a viewer. So they sort of sit into the story like you would in a film if you're, color controlling a story.
Was it just obvious to you at the beginning that when Hitler was represented, he would be represented with kind of a fiery dark red, because that's a color that we associate with malevolence, dominance.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you think
and
about
certainly
it?
The colors of the Reich too. I mean, you can't, black, white, and red are almost, you see those colors together and you almost think the Nazi swastika. So I mean in many ways it's trying to redeem those colors a little bit by putting them to good use. But yeah, early on, the red was pretty easy to identify. And then the teal was something I had to experiment a little to find the sort of warm, cool balance there.
One of the things that you do at the beginning of the book is you make it clear that now we think of Hitler as this shorthand for evil and malevolence. But you do make it clear at the beginning of this book that he had supporters in Germany. And there were people that deliberately did not want to see him for the evil person he was. Now, I want to say, you are not saying, German people, why didn't you figure this out? But you are making clear that in the beginning, he was an attractive figure to a lot of German people. So how did you think about laying that out at the beginning of the book?
Well, I think what people often forget so far away from that story is how Hitler really stole Germany's soul. I mean, they were the heart of culture, of science, of theology. They were the seat of the Christian Reformation. And so Hitler, you know, in retrospect, we look back, and of course, the people of Germany bear a heavy responsibility for the sins of the Third Reich. But I think it is wrong to think that the entire German nation was just one fabric of people. And so Dietrich, I use his story as a kind of representation of those people that were dubious, skeptical. Many of them who were conscientious objectors were shot for not wanting to be drafted, for pacifism. And so Dietrich was part eventually of several conspiracies to actually join an assassination plot. But early on, he was just a dissenter. He was just someone who objected vocally and became a person that was in the Gestapo's crosshairs.
You just used a phrase that you used in the book that I noted, and that was that Hitler stole the soul of Germany. I think mm-hmm. you're right that it's something that we miss in... Again, it's kind of history's shorthand, right? And it's what we tend to do in the rearview mirror. Now mm-hmm. we know how it all came out. Now we know what his ambitions were. But in the middle of it, the way that he was persuading the German people was more than just mere persuasion. He was transforming their own version and idea of what they were too. I think that's a mm-hmm. really great phrase that you use.
Well, and he used the church. This is that's truly, right. to me, the lesson of the book. The story of him fighting back and joining an assassination plot is really, sort of amazing. The lesson is the warning that he gave to any church that would capitulate to the whims of the state, whether liberal or conservative. To me, this was the thing that Hitler saw. The church was a soft underbelly of German culture, and they connected just intuitively German state and German church. Like Lutheranism was Germany. And so Hitler, dressed up as a Christian. He knew that language could connect that people's idea of the folk, the German heart, the German soul, the Reformation, Luther, all these things. It was the first line of assault for Hitler because he knew that they would roll over. And so Dietrich could not believe what was going on. He said very famously, people have lost their minds and lost their Bibles over this.
You make it clear that while there are some pastors speaking out about this or who are uncomfortable, as a whole, the church, which had very deep roots in the community and the culture of Germany in that era, did not rise up to speak as one voice. And mm-hmm. and I wonder if studying Bonhoeffer's life and studying what happened in this moment, you've come to any conclusions about why.
Well, he was seen as kind of a troublemaker by the other theologians, Martin Niemöller and Karl Barth. I mean, people, names you might recognize who later came to see how terribly wrong they were, just felt like, they would say privately to Dietrich, we get it. This is not great, but this is going to cause too much upheaval to face down this right now. And I think we just got to sort of put our heads down. It's a fad. We'll get through it. Many people in sort of upper crust society, which is where Dietrich came from, his parents were quite wealthy and well educated. Many of the upper crust felt like Hitler's was kind of a buffoon. His histrionics were embarrassing. It's a fad. People will get over it. And so there was this sense of sort of put your head down, do your duty to your country, and we'll all get through this.
And that's a really important point that I think is the tension whenever we try to understand history from a contemporary place, right? Mm-hmm. Because the moral compass looks clear when you look back into history, but the lessons mm-hmm. are that even in the midst of the noise and the cacophony and the confusion and the complexity, trying to cease, have some kind of moral clarity is essential. I mean, mm-hmm. I think we cope with that, through every era in which we're trying to figure out who we are and the ideal of what it means to be connected into a community, and then how the circumstances are shaping that identity, right? And then who we are in the midst of that. That's the tension, isn't it?
Yeah, and that, and it's easy. It's just so tempting to want to take Bonhoeffer and bring him into today and say, what would he do today? Is today like what he's going through? And I think there's sometimes a lot of danger in that, a sort of presentism. And I think what we have to do is read Bonhoeffer as a man who lived in this moment and did not know the future, and look at how different his choices were from the people around him. And that's what makes him so unique. He didn't have a great plan. In fact, all of his plans failed. I mean, he made all the right choices, what we would say was right, and he was unsuccessful on everything. I mean, everything failed. His masterwork ethics was unfinished. He was arrested. He was executed on Hitler's direct order. I mean, it's interesting how we now look at his choices and see him as a bold witness, you know, in many ways a martyr for justice. But, you know, as he was living it, he was doing everything wrong.
I'm really glad you brought this up, because I remember reading some of what Pastor Martin Marty wrote about Bonhoeffer and how he noted the contradictions of Bonhoeffer's life. He wasn't the clarion call, and everything he did reflected his clear vision of what was happening. I mean, Pastor Marty says he had a commitment to pacifism even as he took part in this plot to kill Hitler. That was something that also defied the very essence of his faith. His belief in the concept of citizenship, he had a deep belief in that, even though he was committing treason. Mm-hmm. There were deep contradictions at the center of the decisions that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was making. Was he aware of that?
Well, yes. I mean, this was the story of his life. In fact, he really realized eventually that he was called to sin on either side. So there was the sin of action, of committing murder, of committing deception, and there was the sin of inaction, and both were sin. And so Luther famously said, sin boldly. And so he realized he had to do that and asked the Lord to understand and to forgive him. And so those moments of, I mean, he left Germany. He got, using his connections.
I was just going to ask you about that, right?
Well, yeah, he got an escape path. He went to New York. It was his second time to be a professor at Union Theological Seminary. And he got there and he instantly was out of place. He was there, you know, 20 days, 25 days, something like that, and left on the last boat to cross the Atlantic before the start of World War II. So he knew he had run away. He opened his Bible and read, "Those who believe do not flee." And he was just instantly convicted and went back to be with the brethren, even though he basically knew as soon as he got off the boat, he may be shot for sedition.
You know, I really appreciate the way you rendered that, because it gives us the sense of the complexity of his courage, right? That that, as you note, even as he knew he was getting out and there was some important work that he could do outside the borders of Germany, and we know that he grew as an objector and as a theologian and as a thinker, it was those times were really important, and we'll talk about why. But he also knew that he was making a decision that a lot of the people that he was standing up for could not.
Mm-hmm. And he knew he had no right to Germany's future if he was not there in their present. He wrote letters to his friends back home that says, I long to be with you. Even though Germany is sick, I cannot be apart from you. And so it was a choice that he knew was going to be dire. And it ultimately led him to, when he returned, to become, you know, a spy and to join the Abwehr and to, you know, pretend to be a pastor who was pretending to be a normal pastor. But in fact, he was a normal pastor as he traveled abroad. So imagine his friends back home who said, "Dietrich, you were such an anti-Nazi. Now you're part of the Abwehr?" Like, you know, and he would not tell them. I mean, some people knew, of course, but he would not tell everyone. So that alone had to be this tension he lived with every day of feeling like a traitor to his former conspirators.
John, did you bring your book with you, by the way?
I did.
Okay, good, good. Sometimes authors show up without the book, so it's nice that you have
I do not have it memorized.
I'm not going to ask you. I'm going to ask you to read a paragraph or two from it. But to remind listeners, if you've just tuned in to the conversation, John Hendricks is with us, and we're talking about his what we think of, what I think he prefers the term, not graphic novel, but visual novel, and we'll talk about why. But it's called The Faithful Spy, A True Story, Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the Plot to Kill Hitler. We've talked a bit about, as John renders these drawings of Bonhoeffer and Hitler and the politics and culture of the time, how he chose the color palette to do that, how he chose parts of Bonhoeffer's story that you may not be aware of, including this time as a spy. Some of the, I guess what I'm calling the complexity of Bonhoeffer's courage, trying to understand how Bonhoeffer made the decision to object, to stand up, his disappointment in the Lutheran Church of Germany in the time, to leave for a while, for a period that ended up being pretty important to crystallizing his ideas about who he was. If you have some questions, I don't know, interest in how John told this story, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at @CarrieMPR. We got a call, John, from Carlos in Minneapolis, who has actually raised something I wanted to talk about. He says, when Bonhoeffer was in New York City, I understand he went to an African-American church that had a lot of resistance history. How did the church influence him? Is that why he went back to Germany?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that time in New York was critical to framing and really changing his worldview about what oppression looked like and felt like. More importantly, he met a man, Frank Fisher, at Union Theological Seminary, and Dietrich actually felt like seminary in New York was a little weak. At 14 years old, he said, I'm going to be a theologian, and basically had read every book the Americans had read by the time he was 18. So he was kind of weary of New York. But Frank, his African-American friend, took him to Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem. And that was the first time Dietrich experienced what we think of as like the black church. And he loved it. He had never seen a church that was raucous and loud. And the pastor, Dr. Adam Clayton, was well known as being a person who connected the idea of faith and action and you know, roused his audience to live out their faith in a tangible way.
I really
love later.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say Dietrich went with Frank to D.C. To meet with some civil rights leaders and experienced segregation and discrimination when they were not allowed to eat together. Very viscerally. And so that had this lasting effect on how he experienced oppression through the lens of his friend Frank.
I was just going to say, I really love the way you represent his time in the black church and this idea. I think you say his experience in this church was shot through with radical urgency. So to answer Carlos's question, how did that influence the way he thought about needing to return to Germany?
Mm-hmm. Well, he had always been asking this question, what is the church? And the Lutheran model of the church was baked into culture. It was the same thing. And so here in the black church, he saw the church as this a kind of force that was outside of the culture and that was asking people to participate in a very different way. It was dislocated from its own culture. And so he took that energy back directly to Germany and took their music. Frank gave him all these records that had Negro spirituals on them, and he played those to his founding seminary that he started when he got back to Germany. And many people had never heard this kind of music before. So he was completely transformed by his time in New York and Harlem.
Okay, so I've asked if you'll read these are a bit from two facing pages. Now, if I have the chronology right here, I think this is Bonhoeffer's decision to go back to Germany via London. Am I right? To form this seminary?
So he comes to he leaves Germany for a while. He's sort of trying to figure out where he can be, who he is. And so he goes to London for a while. and forms the Confessing Church with several other pastors, which was like a renegade breakaway church that was trying to remain orthodox to the Christian faith that was not subject to the Reich, what they called the Reich Church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, will you read just a bit from those pages?
Mm-hmm. To study with Bonhoeffer was dangerous. It was a clear mark of dissent. It signaled to the government authorities that you might be trouble. Life at Finkelwald was sparse, but full of life and love. Bonhoeffer was an odd professor. As a teacher, he was demanding, like his father. But as a leader, he had an unpredictable streak of whimsy. Dietrich would often cancel classes suddenly to take a day trip to the nearby beach dunes. Or he would postpone the day's activities for a rigorous table tennis tournament. He was quite good. And ever since his childhood, Dietrich had been a natural musician. Now, using his beloved songbook from Frank Fisher, he taught the young seminarians and frequent visitor Ruth hymns and spirituals like Swing Low, Sweet Chariot.
You know what I really love about that is you have, and I think you've done this through the book, you've infused the iconic figure we know with a lot of human dimension. I mean, I didn't know that about the music that he loved and the playing of table tennis. And we really get the full, I think we get a sense of the full humanity. And that, again, informs, I think, the complexity of the courage that Bonhoeffer had to find. Would you also talk about the way you rendered these double pages? Like, again, the color that you used, the dark clouds at the top, how you laid it out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the novel is designed as sort of a hybrid. It's sort of 100% words and 100% pictures. And it's most easily called a graphic novel because that's a category we all sort of understand. But not every page has paneled comics on it. There are some traditional comics in it. But the idea was to sort of make this almost like a sketchbook that had come to life and to paint a very rich picture that used words and images together, which the magic of words and images on the same page is they create a kind of third thing. They create this thing between the words and the pictures, which is often sort of undescribable. It's kind of a gestalt experience. And that's why I make pictures. I mean, I'm not really a scholar. I'm an accidental writer. I'm an artist that loves drawing and loves drawing visual stories. And so I think this format is actually really well suited to Dietrich's story.
So when you say you're an accidental scholar, does that mean that you, once you decided you wanted to tell this story, you really had to immerse yourself in the history of Bonhoeffer? And I'd be interested to know to some of the more unique sources that you went to, you know, draw kind of a full portrait of Bonhoeffer in a way that some autobiography or biography does not.
Yeah, I started this as a complete rookie. I wanted to tell this story in visual form, but I knew I had to do my homework. So, you know, I read basically everything. It took forever. I'm a slow reader. I took lots of notes. And I also, I traveled to Germany because there's not just the textual research, there's the visual research. So when I'm drawing a phone in 1943 that they're waiting to ring to hear about the plot to kill Hitler, I need to know what that phone looks like. So, I went to Dietrich's home in Berlin. I drove south to the border near the Czech Republic where he was executed at Flossenbürg concentration camp and spent time there. And, of course, these are things that I drew and I tried to record my experiences to help my portrayal in the book. But in many ways, some of the best reflections are the ones that you can't sort of define in one page or one moment. It's kind of about marinating in his story and feeling like, you have some kind of right, some kind of experience to tell it.
Call here from Glenn in Burnsville. Hi, Glenn. Thanks for waiting.
Sure. Thanks.
What do you want to say?
First of all, thanks for the great topic. I'm a Presbyterian pastor and have recently discovered that our tendency to dance around this incredibly important topic that you're talking about and not really focus in on what's happening in our culture and with the American people and the kind of abuses of freedom and power we're seeing. And to that end, recently I preached a sermon in our church that received an ovation at the end, which is no small thing when you're dealing with state Presbyterians.
Yeah.
I, I built the sermon around a new confession of faith that was written by a group of scholars at Sojourners that included John Rohr and Walter Brueggemann and Jim Wallis and a bunch of people that are taking this on, and the whole similarities between what happened to the German people and what's happening to us in the American church. There's six affirmations. I'm sure your guest knows about this. Each one of them formulated under the after the Barman Declaration, which said, we believe this about following Christ, therefore we reject this. And I would just love to hear your guest take on that. And just, I'm asking the question of my church and all churches, I think it's time for us to quit dancing around the what to me is more and more obviously a move towards authoritarianism and the church's place in calling that out like Martin Niemöller did in his famous poem. So thank you for taking my call.
You know, Glenn, it's been a while since we've had Jim Wallis on. So you've reminded me that we should go back to the Sojourners for another conversation. But John, go ahead to what Glenn is observing about this.
Yeah, that he's right. I'm a Presbyterian, so I know how hard a standing ovation is in a Presbyterian church. But yeah, I mean, you're right. I want to be careful not to draw. I think anytime we use a Hitler comparison, we just have to be very careful. But I do want to say that in the back of the book, I wrote in my author's note that humanity is not vaccinated against tyrants. We feel like we are because we have vanquished Hitler and he was the king of all tyrants. But it is hard to deny that you see echoes of the same human tropes that happened to the German people, even in our own country. Honestly, I started this book in 2013 because I was interested in the story, and I really thought, I don't think we need this story, really. I think, how many times have we heard the Hitler story? And so it honestly is astonishing that the idea we have had literal Nazis in America recently is stunning to me. One review pointed out that when Hitler starts expounding his ideals from Mein Kampf, in my book, there's a facing page, and all it says on that page is, these were horrid ideas.
Yeah, right. I have it open and to that. Right.
Yeah. And a review said, is that a comment that we need to qualify that in our books for children now, that we need to say that? But, I think we do need to say it. It's clear. We still need to teach this.
I think Pastor Glenn might be interested to know that you, at the church that you attend, is it a Presbyterian church in
yes.
St. Louis? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You, I saw a video where you sit there and sketch during the sermon.
Yes, I do.
And is do I remember this right, that some of those sketches are the work that you are most proud of, that you really love doing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, part of it is I just listen much better when I'm not staring at people talking at me. I'm just a visual learner, so I'll sort of just riff on the sermon and draw live. And there's a kind of magic to drawing for me and the sort of raw and risky energy of a sketchbook. I sort of can't get that in my more composed and refined stuff, so my church sketchbooks are some of my favorite works, for sure.
Have you ever rendered an image or the figure of God? I'm interested in how you'd approach that.
Mm-hmm. I actually did a piece for Christianity Today recently that was about translating John 1:1, and I drew basically God as Word, as the Word. He comes to us as sort of, his power is in creation. His spoken word creates. And so instead of depicting as a formal figure, I depicted him as sort of weird letters and symbols and sort of an explosion of speech acts in a way. So it's tricky, you know. I mean, you don't want to depict him as Santa Claus, but you also want to sort of give people some imaginary sense and push them beyond what they sort of think.
Has your thinking about how to represent God evolve since you've been, you know, mixing faith and art, which is not this is not to say that that's the only topic that you approach, but since you do some of the work in that space, I wonder how your ideas about how to represent God have changed.
Oh, totally. I mean, in many ways, when we look at, you know, why did Jesus tell parables? Basically, because these ideas were very difficult to understand. They're abstract. That there is no. They're there, you know, and so he used word pictures to help us understand. So in many ways, what I make illustrations for the same reason. They're these visual metaphors. So whether it's, you know, depicting God as a lion, as Lewis did in the Narnia books, or depicting Satan as, you know, Mordor and as in the Tolkien books. I mean, there are ways where artists have grappled with the undefinable. And what we do is really look to visual metaphor in some way, which actually I've done in the Bonhoeffer book. You know, Hitler is this feral wolf throughout the book, which, you know, represents this larger idea about him. You know, he's not meant to be a person that has these ups and downs. He is meant to be this sort of figure that grows beyond a man and into this sort of lethal force.
I would imagine it's such a challenge because, you know, to get past the representation of God, if, you know, as a kid, you were probably attending Presbyterian services. I was with my parents as a Lutheran. There's just something that gets stamped in your mind as a kid about what that image of God looks like. And of course, it's fed by, you know, artistic representation and word kind of descriptions. It must be such a challenge to set that aside and then really draw something that you feel is authentically representative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the biblical writers had trouble with it. You know, I mean, he was a pillar of fire. And in Revelation, you read all these great descriptions of you know, swords coming out of mouths and of multi-headed figures, and there is no description for it. So you grasp for these things that we understand, and I think that's why art is so perfectly met with the things of the Bible or of spiritual language. It's really crying out for some nouns. You know, it's like you need some things to look at, and so that's, in many ways, people always ask me, I don't see how you draw during church. There's nothing to draw. I'm like, no, that's the whole point.
Really? You know, I made a point of saying in the introduction that this is a middle grade book. I don't know. Are most of your books middle grade, or is this unusual?
This is my first middle grade long form book. So my other books are picture books, which are for younger readers. Most of them are nonfiction. I wrote a book about John Brown, you know, who single-handedly tried to end slavery, and that didn't go well for him. So, you know, these are challenging topics for young people. But I do think, you know, when I do school visits, kids love talking about moral stakes. They love trying to understand when moral stakes collide and when you do something right and when you do something wrong. So a lot of my books are about that sort of ethical line and when it moves and how it moves and how you deal with that as a person.
Okay, this kind of explains. I mean, as I've noted, you have not shied away from the complexity of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life and decisions. And a lot of these pages are equally textual as they are, you know, artistic images. That has to be something that you decided, my audience wants this, and if they don't get it on the first pass through, they'll get it on the third pass through. What's your approach on that?
Yeah, it's weird. I wrote an outline, and then I made some images that I knew wanted to be there. Page 78, there's an image of Dietrich as David and the Nazis as Goliath, right? That was an image that popped into my head as I was reading about Bonhoeffer and thought, this has got to be a visual metaphor in there. And so there are ways where I sort of pegged the narrative to certain images that I had. I was sort of writing to the visual in that sense. And then, of course, I had to flesh it out and I had to send it to my, you know, beloved editor who had many, many thoughts about what should change and go in other places. And so, you know, it was a very, as every book does, it evolves and changes and there's a ton of work that goes into it that the viewer never sees. But yeah, that idea of what pictures provide that words can't and vice versa, to me, yes, it is a middle grade book, but I am a visual learner. I wish all books had lots of images in it, but somehow we've convinced ourselves that adults should not need images. So writing this for young audiences, certainly that is the target demographic, and they could read it and get a ton out of it. But, you know, to be honest, I've had adults come up to me and say, I've never truly understood how Hitler came to power, and this book explained it in a really clear way.
John, I thought we would close with the music that was important to Dietrich Bonhoeffer when he was in the U.S. and attending those Harlem churches. So thank you.
Thank you. Coming for the
The book is called The Faithful Spy, A True Story, Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the Plot to Kill Hitler by John Hendricks.
Just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.